Welcome to STEM Spots, a weekly science review produced in cooperation with the Missouri State University Department of Physics, Astronomy, and Materials Science.
Hi, this is Dave Cornelison, and once again, you are listening to STEM Spots. I was sitting in the waiting room of a local car dealership thinking about time today. Wondered if you've ever thought about that when it seems to drag interminably over some continuum and you wait and you wonder. And you think to yourself, perhaps, I wonder what time really is. Of course, in those moments when we have a lot of time on our hands is most likely when we think about such things. And so as a physicist, I thought a little bit more about it than perhaps maybe someone else might. Mostly people just get bored or impatient when they're thinking about time. I was thinking about this whole idea of whether time is really a thing at all, whether time is something that exists on its own or whether time is merely a measurement based on physical processes that we observe. So I was reading up on that and talking about it and thinking about it a little bit. I saw that Stephen Hawking, of course, the great cosmologist and physicist, talked about three different arrows of time, one of those arrows of time being the psychological arrow, the idea that we feel within us the inexorable march, the flow of time, so to speak. That, of course, is certainly based in some measure on our own biological and physical processes that make us up. The second might be a thermodynamic kind of arrow of time, distinguished by the growth of entropy. I'm not sure if you've heard that word, but of course, it has to do with the disorder in the state of a system, a closed system. Of course, entropy does not always have to increase. There are certainly systems that can have, if they're open to an outside world, a decrease in the amount of entropy. That's a conversation for a different day. There's also a cosmological arrow of time that might be related to the expansion of the universe. But in all those concepts, we think about measuring things and seeing things that are in nature and using those to measure what we call time. So how do we measure it? Of course, does it have meaning without measure? Certainly in the early parts of mankind's journey on this earth, we saw various kinds of things that we used in order to measure time. We saw periodicity in the world, and we measured the change of the seasons. We saw the sun come up. We looked up into the heavens, and we saw things, and those things could be used to track some kind of a measure of something. This time, as it were, is actually whatever it is that passes between repeated or various kinds of events. So one of the things that we used a lot was the motion of the sun. We could either use the position of the sun during the day, or of course, as many civilizations did, we could create some sort of a sundial where the shadow projected by the sun on some sort of an object would be used to tell what relative time it was. Of course, the precision of such a measurement would be very, very poor. As things began to develop and people started to do things that required a much more precise definition of time, people needed to come up with some other kinds of units. So early on, relatively, there was some decision made locally, certainly, that propagated at some measure throughout the world where people started to say, well, we know what a day is. And so therefore, we'll just arbitrarily divide up this day into 24 measures and into 60 measures and into another 60 measures. And we'll call that fundamental last 60th of a measure. We'll call that a second. Whether you could actually measure it on a routine basis is a debatable point. Certainly early on, they were not able to do so. But they had it there so that they could talk about it and so they could at least understand it in some sort of a psychological sense, even if they could not objectively determine it. Pretty soon, people started to develop kinds of clocks, some sort of a clock. What might they develop? Perhaps they developed some sort of a mechanical object, like a sand glass, where you actually have a sand caught in some sort of a glass fixture with a little bit of an orifice at the bottom, and you turn it on over, and you'll be able to time some sort of a time based on that. Or you might have a water clock. And then people started to develop mechanical clocks that based on gears and springs, or certainly on pendula. It's worked its way to the point where people were to develop pendula that were precisely length-driven so that they could find an exact calibrated measure of time. But it's gotten even crazier than that, and I'm sure you all know about this, such that now the second is defined based on a transition in an atomic state, the light emitted by this atomic state, and atomic clocks can now measure time to one part in something like 10 to the 13th or 10 to the 14th. If you ever go to NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, you'll see that. So the definition of time now is 9,192,631,770. That's 9,192,631,770 periods of radiation for a transition between the hyperfine levels of the ground state of cesium-133. So we've come a long way, even though I was still waiting for a long, long time today at the auto dealer. Once again, this is Dave Cornelison for STEM Spots, signing off.
STEM Spots is available online at ksmu.org.